Boker Tov, everyone. Today's daf in Masechet Ketuvot, brought to you from Eretz HaKodesh, is daf Nun Vav. And we are holding in the middle of the Machlokas about whether the Halacha is like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah or not. And the way that we came out yesterday, remember Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was the one who says that even if there was a Tosefet and there wasn't anything written in the contract at all about whether she should be zochet to the Tosefet before the Chuppah or not, we take for granted an umdana, that is to say an estimation of what it was that the man was thinking when he made this Tosefet, and we say that she can only collect the Ikar HaKetuvah if she never makes it to the Chuppah before he dies or divorces her. She can only collect the Tosefet in the event that she makes it to the Chuppah. So first we thought that the Machlokas was, as we said, whether the halacha is like him or not, that was the machlokas between Rav and Rav Nosson, and that had to do with whether we believe that we can use an umdana, despite the fact that the contract seems to completely ignore the issue, whether an umdana nonetheless works. And it turned out that both Rav and Rav Nosson held that we do say an umdana, in which case it didn't make any sense to explain that the machlokas between them about whether the halacha is like Rav Elazar ben Azariah was dependent on umdana. And therefore, we ended up saying everybody agrees to the fact that we can use an umdana. The question is, what is the umdana? So do we view this idea of his adding the Tosefet before the actual chuppah? Did he perhaps mean that as an investment currently to get her to feel the fact that he loves her and cares about her and so on before she gets to the chuppah? In which case, we wouldn't paskin like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Okay. That's where we were up to, and we got, I believe, up to the fourth line of Yosef Rav Chanina Kamei the Rebbe Yana. Is that correct? Okay, I'm pretty sure. Okay, so what it should say over here is Yosef Rav Chanina Kara, because we're going to see this is one of the standard Rav Chanina Kara. He was a Boki Godol in the actual Psukim and so on. He was a well-known teacher. And he, sometimes we find that he would talk about Inyanim in Tereshu Baal Peh, even though his Iker Esek was to get clear the Targumim and the Psukim and so on. And so he was sitting over there in front of Rabbi Yanai, and he said, Halacha Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. So Rabbi Yanai said to him, Omar Lei, Poke Kari Krach Olivera, get out of the Beis HaMedrash, and you can do your modern teachings about the Psukim and so on. You want to spend your time on Tanakh, you can go ahead and go outside and teach it to the birds. But that's not the halacha. You should stick to your own area of expertise, you know? So, ain't halacha, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, because we don't paskin like that. Now, Rashi surprisingly says over here that Mishum Rabbeinu is Rav. And Tosis points out, that's a terrible thing, because if we have a place where Rav is reported as saying what the halacha was, then why were we looking all over for whether it was Rav or Rav Nosson, who paskin like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, if Rav is quoted Beferish as saying that the halacha is Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah? So Tosis, therefore, argues, and he says that we're talking about Rabbi Yitzchok Bar Avadimu is a Talmud of Rebbe. So Mishum Rabbeinu is actually the door before Rav. And that the halacha is Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Om Reb Nachman Om Shmuel. Halacha Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. This means that according to Rashi, both Rav and Shmuel are paskening like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. And Reb Nachman, so this is Reb Nachman quoting Shmuel. However, Reb Nachman didei omar. Reb Nachman himself did not agree with the quote that he brought from Shmuel. And Reb Nachman himself actually said that ain't halacha Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Whereas the Nahar Doi Mishmei de Reb Nachman Amrei, that the halacha is Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Now, the truth is that this is a easy place to get confused, because it turns out that there were two separate Piskei Halachas. One that was given by Reb Nachman, the famous Reb Nachman, then that's the Reb Nachman that he's always the one that is the Dayan and so on. And that is Reb Nachman Bar Yaakov. But there was another psak by Reb Nachman Bar Abba, which was against it. So it's easy to get confused which Reb Nachman said what. So because of that, there seems to have been some confusion whether Reb Nachman didei Omar in halacha k'Reb Elazar ben Azariah, whereas the Nahar Doi said, no, it's not true. Reb Nachman actually did paskin like Reb Elazar ben Azariah. Even though the latter Reb Nachman, so even though the other Reb Nachman was actually would curse out, this is Reb Nachman bar Abba, he would curse out those Dayanim who had the chutzpah of going against what is written in the Ksuvah, and they would paskin like Reb Elazar ben Azariah. I don't even want to say what he said about them, good heavens. But what he said was is that called Dayanim the Dayan Reb Elazar ben Azariah, hochi v'hochi tavi, I don't want to say what he said. But he said they should only XXXX. Okay. So if that's the case, you'd think, oh, that's pretty stark, you know. I guess halacha is not like Reb Elazar ben Azariah. It doesn't matter. He can curse all he wants, but the bottom line is halacha is Reb Elazar ben Azariah. And in fact, halacha lemaisa is Reb Elazar ben Azariah as the Gemara itself paskins. Now, the question is, how far does Reb Elazar ben Azariah go? What's in there? I don't drink that kind of junk. What are you making a l'chaim for? There we go. Again, Zoom has incredibly put. Ah, excellent, excellent. Okay, I see Gavi's not joining us this morning, but at least we have Akiva. All right, thank you, Akiva. L'chaim, l'chaim tovim, l'shalom. I don't know what Doc recommends in the morning, but perhaps he'll show us also. We know what Richie recommends. I ain't going that way. So, the question is, how far would Reb Elazar ben Azariah go in this issue? So suppose, let's imagine what happened over here, that she did actually get to the chuppah. And the thing is, she never yet had slept with her husband. So her husband died, let's say, maybe even divorced her right after the chuppah, and they never actually consummated the marriage. What would be the din according to Reb Elazar ben Azariah over there? Because we do understand his umdana, but there's still one thing that needs to be a little bit cleared up. And that is, when he's saying that that Tosefet was dependent on the chuppah, did he mean the chuppah literally, or did he mean that which the chuppah usually implies, that we had a chance to consummate the marriage? So was it nichnes ala chuppah v'lo nivala? What would be the din? Is it the chibat chuppah kona or chibat biya kona? There's two levels here of intimacy that we're talking about. Chiba, that is the sense of love and or mutual attraction that's involved over here. So if they make it to the chuppah, so then that means really they've gone through a lot together during this entire year, maybe of being mu'urasim. And that's enough. You know, Baruch Hashem, we're here at the chuppah. The ladies are all crying. The handkerchiefs are out. You know, it looks good. So at this point already, his mecha, that was the way that he had in mind, according to Reb Elazar ben Azariah, when he first gave her that Tosefet. Or is the Tosefet really because of actual intimacy, which is really the source of his feeling at home and connected to her, and that would make him feel the love, but just, you know, the rabbi standing up there at the chuppah, he can't wait till it's over. So basically, what was Reb Elazar ben Azariah saying in terms of the question of the umdana? Well, says the Gemara, take a look at the Braita. Reb Yosef has a Braita that says, when he's quoting Reb Elazar ben Azariah, so this is a little bit of an expansion of on the words of Reb Elazar ben Azariah in the Mishnah, where here Reb Elazar ben Azariah says, Shelo katav lana, dig this, ela al chibat laila harishon. He only wrote that Tosefet because of the love that's going to be expressed in their first night together. Now, I mean, if you're going to tell me that it's the chuppah, so then you can say their first night together, meaning the chuppah. But I mean, who is to say that necessarily that means they're going to consummate their marriage on the first night of the chuppah? No. So why do you say the first night? So if you're going to tell me we're talking about the chuppah, okay, the chuppah is a date, you know. But as far as when they're going to get around to actually consummating the marriage, it may take a while, you know. And that would explain, if it's the chuppah, why we said the first night. But if you're going to tell me that we're really talking about Bia itself, then why talk about the first night? Bia Balaila Harishon Ita Mikan Velechleta. I understand what you're saying, that people always are going to consummate their marriage on the first night. I mean, they may try to tell little Yeshiva Bochum that, but it sure ain't the fact. And therefore, it doesn't make any sense to read it that way. And the correct way, therefore, is that it's referring to that night, that grand night of the chasana, when they do the chuppah. Okay, what are you talking about? You're saying that it's mashma more the chuppah. I understand that maybe first is mashma the chuppah, but night isn't mashma the chuppah. But since when do people only make a chuppah at night? I don't understand what you're saying. Chuppah balayla ita b'yamama leta? There's no such thing. You don't have to have a chuppah at the night. So basically the words first night. I mean, the word first may mean the chuppah, but the word night means actual intimacy. So, I mean, one way or the other, those words are not going to be a basis for me to be able to decide what it is that Reb Loza ben Atzari is talking about. Is he talking about the chuppah, or is he talking about the bia? That is not clear at all. No, wait a minute. And if you're talking about bia, so then bia is only in the nighttime. Well, I mean, it would be just as bad to use the word night. I mean, what kind of strange word is night? I don't know if night refers to chuppah any less than it refers to bia. Because, I mean, you say the same thing. Bia balayla ita bia mamaleta. Didn't Rava say, im haya babayet afel mutar, that even though normally we're careful not to actually have intimate relations in the daytime, but that's because of tzniut. It's not something about the day per se. So if you're in a place where windows are dark and the shades are down, whatever, so then it would be okay. So what would be so strange for there to be a biyom? So it can't be. If you're telling me it must be a reference to either one, because the laila is mashma bia, and the rishon is mashma chuppah. I don't think that the laila is mashma bia. So you're left only with the one thing, right? Which is that actually the word that wouldn't make sense in terms of bia is rishon. Well, hello, Kasha. It doesn't bother me because, I mean, look, the norm is, I understand that, yes, certainly you could have bia in the daytime, but urecharaka mashmalan to bia balaila. Normally, I mean, even if people will talk casually, we have a night together. We understand what they mean when they say a night together. They say we have a day together. It doesn't have sexual implications, Bichlal. So that's fine that we would use the word Lila. That, yes. So that is a sexy word. But the idea of chuppah b'layla doesn't make any sense. So therefore, we still have that question of why it would talk about this idea. Okay, so then, you know what? That doesn't bother me either, because if the Braita is referring to chuppah, it still is not a problem. You say chuppah, I mean, it's the same reason. Chuppah is usually at night, because people will usually make a wedding closer to the time that they actually are going to be together, and therefore, it's just like the whole wedding is much more relates to a nighttime affair instead of a day affair. But it doesn't mean it has to be, obviously. I mean, if you're agreeing that when it comes to bia, it doesn't have to be. It's just that that's the norm. I mean, you can say the same thing about a wedding. It's a wedding night. Everybody says, on my wedding night, right? I mean, the goyim say my wedding day. But the idea over here of the chuppah is, in fact, the nighttime. So that doesn't bother to me. Okay, so then if that's the case, so then it would turn out that the word night works either way, and then the word rishon, that is a good diak, like we said in the beginning. The word rishon would mean that it's a remes to the chuppah. By Ravashi, I got another question. What would be the din over here? Let's say that we've already decided what we're talking about, chiba of the chuppah, as you just proved. But what would be if Lamaisa she ends up as a nida? So that, you know, they scheduled the wedding and things didn't work out, and now she's pores nida as she's going to the chuppah. So nichlas al chuppah pirsa nida. Mao. Even if you want to say, like on the other thing that we asked a minute ago, that what Reb Loza ben Atzari was talking about, that the guy had in mind in giving her this tosefet, was the chibat chuppah, and not the chibat bia. But still, I mean, maybe it needs to be the kind of chuppah that at least will lead right away to consummation. I mean, like the whole thing sort of falls apart when he goes into a chuppah. Now it turns out that he's not going to be able to be with her until she's over her period. I mean, what a mess up, right? So then, enochinami, I mean, we know this happens very often, and the bottom line is that it really does hurt the echiba. I don't feel the love tonight. And that is exactly the problem. So then maybe even according to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, if he holds normal echibat chupa, but this is not enough of echibat chupa. So im tim tzalom echibat chupa kona, it would have to be a chupa de chazi levia, of a chupa de lo chazi levia, lo. Or maybe there is that special, you know, the marriage moment, and what's kovea is the handkerchief and the tears and the ladies. Take, okay, that is a big issue. Now, there's a big machlokas we've shown you whether this is a general question about a chuppah she'ena ru'uya levia, or is there an emotional question that relates specifically to the issue of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and whether the man intended to provide a tosefet under these conditions. Most of the Rishonim learn that the only thing we were asking, take a look at the context, the only thing that we were asking over here was a libid of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. We weren't asking whether technically this has a din of a chuppah or not, right? However, the Rambam learns that this is a shayla bichlal about whether a chuppah is considered to be a chuppah if it's ein ru'uya levia, and since we leave it as a teku, it would mean that all of the things that are defined by a chuppah would not actually be chal if it was a chuppah she'ein ru'uya levia, possibly. So at least it would remain as a suffix. Okay, this is an issue. This is not really our place to discuss the details of it, but as you could see, this could have drastic implications. Now, let's talk about the Mishnah that says that according to Rabbi Yehuda, you could actually get away with effectively reducing the ksuva by writing a proper ksuva and not being over on the takana, and then she writes a receipt for money that she never got. So let's say you write her in the ksuva 200, like you would write for any betula, and she writes a receipt, which is called a shover. It's called a shover because it breaks the power of the collecting shtar. She writes a shover for 100, right? That's the words that he used. Ratza kotev le betula, and then he kotevet kibalti mona. Now, the problem is that this implies that sover abuted de kotvim shover. The question is, normally speaking, let's forget about the ksuva issue. In the event that somebody has a contract on you, and that you owe him, let's say you owe him 200, and you actually paid 100. So then what happens? Does he write you, I have received from you 100, but he gets to keep the original contract on 200? Or is his contract no longer effective and we have to rewrite the contract to 100? So this is a big machlokas, a general machlokas, Gavi, about kotvim shover. What is the question about kotvim shover? Because on the one hand, if I write the guy a shover, then I am forcing him to take in exchange for his good hard cash that he gave me a piece of paper that can be lost, can be eaten up by the baby or the doggy when he was doing his homework. Or, for that matter, it could be flooded away. I don't know. I mean, like, what's going to happen if now, 20 years later, this guy brings the contract and he says, well, sir, your mortgage is due, and you've only paid me a little bit. What are you talking about? I paid you half up front 20 years ago. Do you have a receipt? No, I don't have a receipt. Man, my whole house was flooded. All my papers are gone. If you don't have a receipt, you're going to have to pay me. So therefore, forcing somebody to accept a piece of paper in exchange for his cash is not really fair. On the other hand, forcing a guy to rewrite the contract, this is how Rashi learns the problem here, even though the Gemara later is going to say it differently. Forcing a guy to rewrite his contract means that he loses his she'ibudim from the original date. Because now if he goes and tries to collect from the field that I sold, and I only have this later version of the contract that's dated 5 years afterwards, now I can't go and collect from him. That's not fair either. So this is a big machlokas. What do we do under these circumstances? Since over here, Rabbi Yehuda takes for granted, and he says, well, she just writes him out a receipt. So then the implications are that a receipt is a valid way of responding to a partial payment, right? That's what happened over here. But the problem is that we know in Bava Basra, it's not like that. Because over there, Vatnan, Misha Parah Miktzat Chovo, here's Rabbi Yehuda, somebody pays up partially a loan. Rabbi Yehuda says, you're going to have to make a new shtar. Ya Khalif, you got to change the shtar. That means that Rabbi Yehuda does not believe that you can write a shover. So what's he saying over here in the Mishnah? She should write that I got from you 100. That goes against his entire shita. It's Rabbi Yossi who says, yichtov lo shover. So if Rabbi Yehuda doesn't hold of a shover, how come over here he says that she should write the shover? Rabbi Yehuda did not mean to say she gives him a piece of paper. Rabbi Yehuda meant to say that the shover is written into the ketuvah. In other words, the Edim sign on the ketuvah, and they write, V'hi hodata lefanenu shuhu parameya. So that way, the moment that the ketuvah is presented, the shover is presented. So then you have full protection, right? The truth is that if you think about it, it isn't necessarily such good protection. Because consider the issue of whether she would claim that the ksuva is lost. Now, she would still have the right to collect, because we always rely on the virtual shtar, so to speak, that's kept in the bezdin, right? So then if that would be the case, she could always claim that the ksuva was lost and then still get her payment. So, I mean, what Tarsus talks about the different issues of what would be raised in here, but basically, if we're talking about a ksuva that has in it, let's say, a tosefet, which is often, so then it isn't worth it for her to hide the ksuva, because then she won't be able to collect the tosefet. So she's going to end up losing more if she hides the ksuva than if she doesn't. And so on and so forth. And the discussions about what happens if the ksuva actually is lost, then she can only collect because there are witnesses, but the witnesses would have had to read the ksuva, because otherwise how are they sure that it was the ksuva that was burnt up or floated away? So they're going to be able to say that they saw the shover mitocho. Anyway, take that in mind, because obviously we're not kids here that we're just, you know, yeah, well, there's many, many issues that the Bezdin is going to have to take into consideration in what might come out of this deal. So we're talking about cases where all of that was considered, and that's all that Rabbi Yehuda is saying. So this is how Rabbi Yirmiyah understands it. You write the shover in the ketuvah itself, and therefore there's no problem of forcing somebody to retain a piece of paper. By Omer, you don't have to say that. Oh, come on, guys, it's not the same at all. Obviously, Rabbi Yehuda could say, normally, that I actually will never say that you can tell somebody to keep a piece of paper. But that's because if the paper is lost, then he has no way of protecting himself, right? So we say, how's he going to obey? You're b'chai of him to keep this piece of paper, make sure nothing ever happens to this piece of paper. But what would happen over here if he loses the shover? What would happen? He'd have to pay the ksuva? So let him pay the ksuva! There never was any cash that actually passed from him to her. She was doing him a favor and giving it. So if he loses the paper, so fine. He messed himself up, lose the paper. What, we have to protect every idiot from everything? So he'll pay the ksuva like every other person. So how does this compare? I mean, it sounds silly. You're telling me, well, I mean, it's not fair. He's got to keep the ksuva. Not fair for what? He didn't pay a penny. So what's not fair about it? Therefore, it says Abaye. Look, I mean, even if we're talking about a normal shover, of course, in a normal case where you're talking about a shover on a debt, so bishlamahatam vaday pare, he actually paid the guy money, and dilma mirchas tivarta. Maybe something will happen to this piece of paper of the shover that you gave him, and that's not fair. And then the guy who lent the money is going to take out that original shtar and he'll say, hey, buddy, come on, you got a receipt? No? Well, too bad. But over here, what are you saying? That he literally gave her money? Of course he didn't give her money. She was writing. It was just all imaginary, right? It was milta be'alma hidamrele. It's just words. It's not money. So if he can't take care of his words, so let him suffer. Elo Natri didn't take good care of it, so you would have said anafshe. So now he's going to have to pay the ksuvas. What's the big deal? I'm a chiv to protect him. That's no problem. So now I understand why Abaya wouldn't want to say like Rabbi Yirmiyah. I mean, Rabbi Yirmiyah is limiting the case where you wrote the shofar in the ksuv. I mean, it doesn't say that. It just says that she writes to him, which is mashma just on a scrap of paper on the back of a paper napkin. I mean, I don't know. Where does it say that the shofar is in there? But so, of course, he wants to say that in general, it's an irrelevant question to the particular case. But why would Rabbi Yirmiyah ignore the obvious answer that Abaya was giving, that this case, it doesn't really matter if we force the guy to take a shofar? I mean, it's just sort of weird to make such an answer that he wrote it in the ksuva. My time alone, I can't buy it. Because, listen, the point when we were asking him, and obviously the Gemara wasn't stupid when it's asking the question, I thought Rabbi Yehuda doesn't hold of shofar. I mean, over here, what do you care? It's just a way of getting him out of paying the full ksuva. Well, we're not protecting anybody. So isn't it sort of a baya obvious? The Gemara's question always was, if the modality of payment is never with a shofar, so then Rabbi Yehuda wouldn't have said use a shofar over here. If Rabbi Yehuda holds you don't use a shofar in cases where you pay it up, does it make sense that in this particular case we'll say, no, that's what she should do, write a shofar? So then, I mean, if you do that, you're just violating all the norms of prepayment, right? So Rabbi Yehuda would never do that because he would say, listen, it would be obvious that he would make a gzera to not to write a shofar in this case, because if he does, then people will assume that a shofar is a valid way of responding to a prepayment. So no, I don't believe that that's the pshat, says Rabbi Yirmiyah. Because of that, he has to explain how in this case it would be consistent with Rabbi Yehuda, even if we would write the shofar. And the only way we can do that is by writing the shofar betocha. Now, what is, however, fascinating is that it says she has to write. Now, why does she have to write? Why can't she give just a verbal receipt? You know, you just say to the aide, listen, guys, you know, he paid me 100. So take that into consideration. You know, and then they could write that up if they want to and so on. But the question is, would that really make any difference that it says, Dafka, I have to write it? Why do I have to write it? Basically, if I say that 100 of it is paid, do I really care paid, not paid? The point is that I've reduced the power of the ksuva by 100. Because, I mean, Hodas Baldin Kameid Imdami, I'm saying that the ksuva doesn't have the power. We don't have to ascertain officially that we have a receipt and so on. Now she's going to have to prove that she didn't get it. And this is a Tanai Sheba Mammon. And a Dover Sheba Mammon, we know that Rabbi Yehuda holds that any Tanai that you make on a Dover Sheba Mammon, the Tanai is Kayam. It doesn't matter whether it even runs against to what it says is your chiyuv in the Torah. Because over here, the whole issue is that what? We're going to have to, what Rabbi Yehuda seems to be saying is, we're going to have to do this in a very legal fashion. Because it's absolutely essential that the ksuva be written up according to the takana, and the ksuva is merumas in the Torah, and that's the din of the matayim, which is the chamishim shekel, is matayim zuz. And you can't just say, but what I've done essentially is I've made a condition that you can't use it to collect the whole 200. So you would think that's because, well, you can't make a condition about something that's in the Torah. But the problem is that Rabbi Yehuda Shita all over is that you can do exactly that. And that since it's Dover Shebemomain, then you still have the power to make whatever condition you want. And I'll prove it to you. That if you make a tnai And let's say, here's a perfect case. The Tanya, Omer Lisha, a guy goes over, he says, listen, Hareya Mekudeshet Li, I'm doing a regular marriage, except one little condition, you know? Almanat She'en Lach Alay She'er Ksut V'ona. You know, even though the Torah says, She'era Ksuta V'onata Lo Yigra, over here, I want you to agree that we're making a condition that our condition would not be Mechayev She'er Ksut V'ona. So then he's going against the Torah, right? He's making a t'nai. He's matne gavi matne al mashakatuv b'Torah. That is the operative phrase here. Somebody makes a condition about something which is written in the Torah. So he's look at this. He takes advantage the moment that gavi goes to write, and now he sticks up the old cup of I don't know what's in there, and I'm supposed to go along with it. That was not a coincidence, Barnea, nor is it a coincidence that Zoom has put you and Gavi together here. Sheesh.
I'm holding cup.
Good. Okay, so he makes a condition like this. So this is a Masa Mashkatuba Torah, right? What's the din? So the Tanakamu's Rebbe Meir says, look, the din is that a condition of that sort does not have legal validity. And therefore, what's the halacha? The condition disappears, and the facts remain. So in other words, she is mukudeshes without any condition. And he's going to have to provide sher kesut v'ona, divrei Rebbe Meir. So over there, t'na'o batel, she's mukudeshes, and the t'na'i is batel. So says Rebbe Meir, but Rebbe Yudah says, wait a minute. There's three components, sher kesut v'ona, right? Now, sher and kesut, the way we came out was machlokas precisely, which was what, but she'er and ksut is a reference to providing food and providing clothing. That's monetary. Monetary, you can make whatever condition you want. So he does not have to provide clothing or food. But ona, we came out with intimacy. That's monetary. No. And therefore, Rebbe Yudah says, that you can't do anything about. So there I agree that that part of the Tanai is bato. But a dover shebamama t'na'o kayam. So then, according to Rebbe Yudah, what she says should not have to be an ersatz document, right? In other words, what we're taking, the Gemara is a little iffy here, gentlemen, because there really is no difference just because I'm writing down what I had said orally. I mean, why is one of them considered to be Masa Mashkatu B'Torah and the other one considered to be a valid way of doing the Ksuva? So, I mean, it's a little bit strange, but what we're taking for granted over here is that if you write it, then the whole thing seems to be legal. You know what I mean? You brought the contract of the Ksuva that you're suing with. He brings the wave. In terms of the shover. And okay, so there really was a ksuva, there really was a tashlumin. That I understand. But if I don't do things in a legal fashion, then it's very suspicious looking. And the whole thing looks like, yeah, she's saying she got 200. Because basically what she's saying is, I'm accepting the contract on condition that it's only going to be used by me to be Tovea 100. And that's Masna Mashkatu B'Torah. That's what we're taking for granted. So the problem is, if Rebbe Yudah anyway holds that Masna Mashkatu B'Torah is okay, so then why does it have to have this veneer of legality around it? That's our question. You understand the whole thing is a little, it's not accurate 100%, but it's basically talking about what we're trying to establish as a veneer of legality to the thing. So why would Rebbe Yehudah insist that it be written? Answers the Gemara, fascinating answer, that Rebbe Yehudah Dafka holds that the Ksuva is not the Oraisa, and that therefore, and the truth is, even according to Rebbe Meir, that he says that the Ksuva was a Oraisa, he's going to be Masmashkas Baturin, and so on, even there, you'd still be able to ask, well, what about the Almana? The Almana is certainly not the Oraisa. It's only the Mohar HaBetulot that's the Oraisa. So anyway, you're going to have to say that once we were Koveya, the Dinim of the Ksuva, it went across the board, whatever the Ksuva is. The Ksuva for an Almana, the Ksuva for a Besula, the only difference would be that when it comes to the Ksuva, we would write the Chazi Lachim Midi Oraita, which is what our minhag is to write, which implies that it really is a deraisa, but as the Rishonim explained, not necessarily because it could mean the Chazal Chimi deraita as implied in the Torah, as hinted to in the Torah. Fine, we don't write that for the Amona, obviously, but the dinim would be the same. Okay, so Rabbi Yehuda holds the whole Ikar idea of a ksuva is entirely derabbanan, and therefore we have to be very machmer on it. If you allow people to be masa masha ketuv b'Torah, okay, fine. So it's a way out of it, but they don't take it with less sense of seriousness. They know it's a deraisa. But if you deal with a derabbanan that way, you end up making the whole thing just fall apart. Oh, yeah, it was just a drop on it, so we pretended that it was paid up. So therefore, we have to be more machmir with the claw that we had. Gavi, we've had this before, but we forgot to write it down. Chachamim asu chizuk l'divrehem yoter mishel Torah. Now we have a claw that there are places where the chachamim are more machmir than on a deraisa because of this very issue. Well, now, wait a minute. Well, I can show you that Reb Yehuda does not hold that. I mean, what about the idea of the right of the husband to pay rot? That's part of the ksuva. Remember, another one of the complicated virtual tanaim and so on is that the husband, as we said, that it's going to be an exchange for his providing insurance against kidnapping and so, but that one of the things is that wherever there's money or property that she's brought in and it's producing profits, those are called peirot, and the husband has a right, so long as they're married, to utilize those peirot. So if that's the case, the din over there ought to be that osur rabbanan chizuk ledivreya, and that you can't make any kinds of tanayim, right? But that, even according to Rabbi Yehuda, is not true. Because what about the Mishnah we have later on in the Masechet, where Rabbi Yehuda omer, lo'olam u'achel peirei peirot ad shi'ichtov la'din u'dvorim en li b'nechasayach u'beperoteim u'beperoteim ad olam? That if you want to enable her to maintain the rights to the peirot of her property, it would be insufficient to say, and the husband has agreed that he is not going to be taking the peirot. Because what will happen then, if he doesn't take the peirot, what he still is legally able to do is invest the peirot. So now she'll say, okay, but those peirot are mine. They are, but we're going to buy a shopping plaza with that peirot. And that shopping plaza is going to generate a lot of cash. And guess who's going to use that cash? But you said that you don't get peirot. I'm not getting peirot. I'm getting the peirot of the peirot. I never said I wouldn't get the peirot of the peirot. Now, did I? Oy vey, these poor women. Anyway, so the only way to make certain, if she's got a good lawyer, that that's not going to happen, is not to say, I will not eat your peirot or the peirot of your peirot, because then you'll invest the peirot of the peirot, and you'll eat the peirot of the peirot of the peirot. So you've got to throw in the words, ad olam. Now, this has a lot to do with Birkas HaTorah, you'll notice, right? Because now the question is whether you're supposed to say, is it just for us and our children, or does it include our children's children, and Zerah Zareinu, and so that's the whole question. Say peirot of peirot. Anyway, so the question over here is that according to Rabbi Yehuda, I thought Rabbi Yehuda says that you can't do that in any event, right? And so you'll say, okay, but it means over there that you write it. We said that if you put a veneer of respectable judicial words in it, then it sounds very official, right? No, not right. Because what we went through in the sugya over there is we ended up proving that even though the word that was used over there, according to Rabbi Yehuda, was kotev, my kotev, kaimalon, that my kotev, it just means that he says it. And that over there, it does not have to be put into a legal document. And if that's the case, then apparently, even though it's only derabbanan, Rabbi Yehuda says you're able to make a condition. And that condition would be chal. We don't say osu chizuk ledivrei. Now make up your mind. So why does he say over here that we have to write it specifically? Omer Abaye, look, there's a big difference between a ksuva and the peirot, okay? Everybody has a ksuva by definition. Not everyone has a wife who's brought in property and money that's being generated. And what are we talking about over here? You know, the 97th percentile. I mean, who you're talking about, Elon Musk's wife. I mean, who are you talking about? I'm talking about regular, you know, simple people, not the high flyers. So for the high flyers, the Rabbanon, we're not a Sukhizik Ledivrayim. Remember, the Rabbanon always deal with Milta Deshchicha, Gavi. Milta Deshchicha of the Bar Rabbanon Chizik. That's because Milta Deshchicha is the general term for where it is that the Rabbanon get involved in getting worried about the implication. A Milta Delo Shchicha, that's the correct way to put it, Gav. Milta Delo Shchicha Lo Gozer Bar Rabbanon is the main way that we would use this terminology. So something that is not the common situation, we're not going to get involved in. And this is a Milta Delo Shchicha. Now, well, wait a minute. Is that true? There is a din on a milta, which is shchicha, and I'll show you over there that Reb Yehuda agrees that even there, where it's a milta de shchicha, that the Rabbanan did not make a chizik l'divrayim. And that is the truck driver issue. And we had this issue before. So we've got these two trucks, right? And these are trucks. I'm sure Richie remembers the old grocery store boat that used to come around the island to be able to get your groceries from the boat. Well, if you lived far away in the days before everyone had cars, they would come around with a truck and they would sell. Yeah, you remember that? So they would come around and they would sell groceries from, you know, like they do today for ice cream for kids, you know. So they would bring a grocery store in a truck, park it on the block every Tuesday morning, let's say on your block, and you would buy in that grocery store. So these are called chamarim. In those days, they used donkeys. And remember, like in the old...
There was a bus.
That's the same thing. Yeah. This is a truck, a bus, and so on. So, so the issue would be, as we had before, you've got two of these buses come into town, you know, and one driver says, you know, really, you don't want to buy my stuff. My stuff is not mitukan. I don't take off trumas and maizras, you know, not to mention the fact that my food's not as good as the other guy's. You'd be smarter to buy from the other guy. And there the question is, in the next town, we can easily assume that it's going to be the other way around. You know, so this way, one guy looks honest, and therefore everybody's, oh, you can trust him. He says this guy takes off trumas and maizras, which is a great way for them to make business from the charedim, because now, you know, even though they don't have a hechsher, this guy looks like he's serious, you know? So this is what they do in every place, you'd think. Anyway, so the halacha over there is that the Rabbanan accepted that, and they did not make a chizik l'divrayim. Ditnan, it says beferish in the Mishnah in Demai, which Moshe Forman you'd think would show his face for, but even that not, that hachamarim shenichvesu le'ir. So if you've got these buses come into town, v'omar achad mihem, sheli chadash v'shel chaveri yashan, if one of them says, my stuff is just, I remember we went through this, that it does not mean chodash and yashan in terms of the iser of chodash, because we don't have any din, as Rashi points out, of amei ha'aretz b'chayshet damat chodash. So it doesn't mean that. It means chodash v'yashan, literally. Is it fresh produce? If it's fresh, it's not as good. Grain requires time to dry out. So if he's saying, look, my stuff was just picked, you don't want to buy my stuff, buy from the next guy. And, or he says that mine is actually not mitukan for trumas and maizras, but this other guy, he takes off trumas and maizras. So ain't on their money because it looks very suspicious. Reb Yehuda, of all crazy things, is the one who says they are Ne'amani. But I thought, according to Rabbi Yehuda, that the Chachamim also chizik l'divrayim, how come over here they're not chashin and legomli? And they're going to make people like, even though somebody's scratching his head, you don't think this looks suspicious, honey? Yeah, but the rabbi said it's only the Rabbanan, so we don't need to worry. Okay, but that's exactly what it was that Rabbi Yehuda said we're worried about. So how come over here he's not worried about it? Rabbi, that doesn't bother me so much because, look, it could be that a vadai the divrayim of the Rabbanan Chizuk, a suffik the divrayim lo of the Rabbanan Chizuk. Remember, we're talking about over here when we're dealing with Demai, that we have a suffik whether they took off trumas and maizras or not. So even though the Rabbanan would be also Chizuk with divrayim, where we're talking about a straight out takana de Rabbanan, and now people are going to be mizalza. But when the whole thing was originally a suffik, Over there, they were makel. Rava says, what do you got to change the rules for? It's very simple. The whole idea of d'mai is less than a suffet. Because b'd'mai hikilu, the concept of d'mai, remember, itself is almost outrageous. Because in terms of the halacha, there's a rov ame ha'aretz or ma'asrim all over the Torah. We rely on rov. Why all of a sudden are we not relying on rov? I mean, do you understand? This is a very serious thing to take into consideration. Do you understand the horrific impact that was made in a negative way by the takana of d'mai? Remember that the takana of d'mai split Klal Yisrael into chaverim and ame ha'aretz. That was horrific. It had all kinds of, we see in the Gemara Chagig, it had all kinds of implications. Like Beit Shammai points out to Beit Hillel. And not only that, the situation that we have today, in which people won't eat in each other's homes, this hechsher is good, this hechsher is no good, all of that is a natural ending of, who knows where it'll end, but it's a natural consequence of this takana of d'mai. Now, if you're going to start making something that is so outrageous overly serious, it's going to really be a problem. Therefore, it says Rava, in general, the Rabbanan took the tack that if we're creating a din, that we're going to ignore the halacha of Rov in the Torah, we're certainly not going to make it serious to the extent that people will learn a completely wrong system of values from it. So Dafka, when it comes to d'mai hikilu, the Rabbanu were makil, but dafka on d'mai. Don't ask me why the Rabbanu didn't make a chizik l'divrayim for d'mai, for heaven's sakes. It's not because it's a suffix. It's because it runs against the dinim of the Torah. And it's saying, don't rely on rov. That's the answer. Okay, moving on to the next piece of the Mishnah. Rebbe Meir Omer. Look, if you're pochet, you write a ksuva for less than 200 for a petula, or less than 100 for an amana. That is an illicit marriage. For all I'm concerned, you could put a little red button on the front door and have everybody ring the bell. I mean, this is promiscuity. This is not a wedding. What kind of craziness is this? This you call a wedding where a woman feels that she's being taken advantage of? Now, this next piece is an absolutely stunning addition to our issue of Shaktu, Alibi the Rebbe Meir. Watch this diak, because it's really beautiful. Note that what it's saying over here, kol ha-pochet. What would happen if you were pochet, gentlemen? What would happen if you made it tonight and you said, Hareini kilu itkabalti? What if she did that? What if she made the tanai that we just said that according to Rebbe Yehuda you can make, right? So what if you did that? According to Rebbe Meir, as we said, nothing. It wouldn't make the slightest difference. You could write what you want. You could have her say what you want. That ketuvah is going to be a full ketuvah. And if he walks into Bezin and says, well, she already agreed that she, I don't, they'll say to him, get out of here, buddy. We don't allow those kind of tana'im. You owe her a full ketuvah. Don't give us that, right? But Rebbe Meir didn't say that. Rebbe Meir didn't say that if the woman ends up receiving less than 200, he writes, he says, anybody who writes less than 200, even if it isn't going to work, even if he made it tonight, kol ha-pochet, if you work things out, that it looks like she's going to get less than 200. That is a biaznus. So that means that Alma, kasavatno batel, what he's saying is that if you write it, you can forget about what you wrote because it's useless. And nonetheless, even though itla, she is going to get the full amount of the ketuvah, that itself makes it a biaznus. The fact that he wrote it for less. Why? Because he fooled her into thinking that she's really only going to get 100. So because of that, psychologically, it's still a biasnus. So even though she's completely protected as far as the Bezdin is concerned, and if she had a good lawyer, the lawyer would tell her, lady, don't worry about it. He's an idiot. He thinks he can get away with this. He'll never get away with it. She doesn't know that. And the very fact that she doesn't know it means that the bias is a bilasnus. So what we're talking about over here is not the actuality of her being protected, which you would think was the shaktu. It's the psychology of being protected. And if she believes that she's not, or if she's even in doubt, I don't know what's going to happen. That doubt is enough to destroy her security in the marriage and turns the marriage into a farce in which it becomes an illicit cohabitation in technical terms, right? Wow. That is amazing. So this means Havila bi'ilato bi'ilat znut. Incredible. But I thought that Rabbi Meir says that it's only a matnel mashekatu batoratna o batel. But if he's matnel mashekatu v'nedrabonan, tno o kayam. So how do we learn from here that Rabbi Meir is saying even the attempt to be pochet, it's not an attempt, it's real. No, it's not. Because kasova Rabbi Meir, akshuva is the oraisa, and therefore it will not work. And basically, you take a look in the Braisa, Tanya, Rabbi Meir Omer Kolapochet Lebetula Mimataim Laamona Mimona Harezu Be'ilat Znut. Rabbi Yossi Omer, no, you're allowed to do that. He says, not only is it chal, it's even mutter to give her less, says Rabbi Yossi. And Rabbi Yehuda says, well, now, I wouldn't say you could just go ahead and write it for less. You've got to write it for the full amount. But if you want to effectively reduce it, like we said in the Mishnah, kotev lebetula regular shtar of matayim, and he kotevet lo it kabalti mimcha mona, or you could write lamona mona, vihi kotevet lo it kabalti mimcha chamishim. So are you trying to tell me that according to Rabbi Yossi, you can actually give a ksuva on its face value for less? Take a look at this price of Ramini. Ein osim ktuvat isha metaltalin mipnei tikuna olam. Now, this is an extension of the issue that we spoke about before, about security. Do not secure a ksuva by giving a woman a car. I'm saying, see my Rolls Royce? My Rolls Royce is the backup for your ksuva. If I would ever divorce you or if I die, just go and take the Rolls Royce, right? So you tell, oh, gee, that's great. You can't do that. Why? For the benefit of the world. Okay, so apparently we're worried that somebody may steal your Rolls Royce. And then what's going to happen to her? So she's not really secure, right? She says, oh my gosh, if anything happens to that Rolls Royce, I'm finished. But the problem is, for Amini, what are you going to do with the bride that is exactly the opposite? Ein osim, we said. Here we said, ein osim ktuvat isha metaltalin. Rabbi Yossi says, this is what I meant to say. Omer Rabbi Yossi, v'chima tikkun olam yesh bezu. What do you mean? Tikkun olam? What kind of tikkun olam are we talking about? Halo ein ketsuvim. Do you have any idea what this thing is going to be worth at the time that she's going to need to collect her ksuva? It may be worthless at that time. There may be no such thing as gaz. And this is a gaz guzzler. And now she's coming to collect. What is that thing? Where do you plug it in? No, this was something used to put some liquid in. Liquid? What are you, crazy? Get out of here. This thing is worthless. So you'll say, but it's a museum piece. Are you kidding? There's 100,000 of these running around in people's garages. There's not even room in the junkyards for them. So basically, says Rabbi Yossi, they're worthless. No, I don't understand. I mean, so isn't he saying the same thing? That's what the Tanakhama said. The Tanakhama said you can't make a Rolls Royce a guarantee for a ksuva. So what is Rabbi Yossi saying? El alav. The only way to understand it is like this. The Tanakhama is insinuating that you never know, somebody may steal the car. You know, so therefore, mipnei tikkun olam, but you can insure against that. Because suppose you guarantee the car. Right? So suppose you tell her, you have the Rolls Royce, and here's the insurance policy paid up for the next 100 years, that if the car is stolen, here's the money. So anyway, you're going to be covered. So according to the Tanakhama, that would be good enough. So basically what we're saying is like this. The Tanakhama, for all intents and purposes, is saying, that's where we don't have insurance. Then you could make your Rolls Royce her ksuva, right? Comes along Rabbi Yossi to say, you call this a tikkun olam? This is a tikkun olam because you have an insurance policy? What does the insurance cover? Stealing? flooding? Does it cover the fact that they used to put this liquid into this machine and it's currently totally worthless? No. Metaltoline, you have no idea what it's going to be worth. It goes up, it goes down. I mean, it's ridiculous. Once upon a time, people would pay for feathers, whatever. Who knows what kind of crazy, crazy things. Tulips. I guarantee you a beautiful tulip. Tulip was worth $100,000. Yeah, great. That's not worth 10 cents. So therefore, you cannot rely on metaltoline at all. That's what Rabbi Yossi is adding over here. So he's saying, and if he was makabel alav achrayut, then you could amayosim v'halo inketsuvim. So even if you have an insurance policy, you can't use it. Okay. Anyway, getting back to what I was concerned about, here's my question. If even in that case, where it's only a suffix, right? We don't want to give her a Rolls Royce because it may end up being worthless. So hashtu ma hasim the dilma pakase Reb Yossi is saying you never know whether it's going to be worth any money. And there Reb Yossi says, and that's bad enough. You're telling me that up front you can actually make it less? That makes sense. Hocha de valeka pachata lo kol shekein. Answers the Gemara, no comparison. No? Okay, Ashley, what kind of crazy argument is that? In the case where we're giving her a Rolls Royce, she thinks, wow, this guy's really covering me. I'm actually secure as could be. What girl on the block has a Rolls Royce to protect her ksuva? Little does she know that she is set up for a big fall. And this Rolls Royce may be worth nothing. So she was never mochelet. You fooled her. So this is the exact opposite. It's a mirror image of the case of Rebbe Meir. Over here, you fooled her into thinking she was secure. And she wasn't secure. And therefore, that's why Rabbi Yossi says it's no good. Because she doesn't realize that, and she never was mochelet. But in this case, if I actually tell her, listen, you know, let's make up that your ksuba is going to be less, so then she knows, and she was mochelet. So that should be just fine. Okay, Rabbi Yossi. Whew. Got some important new ideas over here of extensions of our shoktu. In both the reality of the shoktu, the psychology of the shoktu, and the various questions of insurance. By the way, you might be able to provide insurance against value reduction, as Tosfos discusses. That would perhaps be okay in the event that you're guaranteeing its level of value. But, okay, we'll get to that discussion, Bezrat Hashem, later on the Masechet. Meanwhile, wishing you all a day of Besurot Tovot, Yeshuot, V'Nechamot, Nechamot.